Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the attempts to put the Kaiser on trial after the First World War. The story of the remarkable 19th century Irish mathematician who helped make possible the digital revolution and the burning of Cork during the War of Independence. We'll also explore the contribution of an order of nuns to Ireland, America, Australia and New Zealand. And to end the show, we'll get a quirky insight into a Wicklow townland. Last week, we looked at the life and legacy of Muhammad Ali, and we explored how he transformed the world of sport and celebrity. And that was our Easter Sunday special. And if you want to listen back to that or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or go directly to iTunes. We begin, though, with the trial of the Kaiser. In the immediate aftermath of the armistice that ended the First World War, the Allied nations of Britain, France and Italy agreed to put the fallen German Emperor Kaiser Wilhelm II on trial in what would have been the first ever international criminal tribunal. In Britain, Lloyd George had campaigned for re-election on the slogan, "Hang the Kaiser," but the Italians had only lukewarm support for a trial and there was outright resistance from the United States. A new book by the renowned legal scholar William A. Shabas sheds light on perhaps the most important international trial that never was. The book is called The Trial of the Kaiser. It's published in hardback by Oxford University Press and costs £24.99 sterling, so about €28. And I'm delighted to welcome the author William A. Shabas to the show tonight. Bill, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's an extraordinary story and it's one that I hadn't been aware of. I wonder how close did they come to putting the Kaiser on trial, and would it have been a fair trial if it had been held?
Well, I think they came close in a way. I mean, what's hard to determine is how much real will there was, and it ebbed and flowed over a period of about a year and a half after the Kaiser lost power and fled to the Netherlands. So, you know, at different points in time, one can see more, greater or lesser enthusiasm for doing it, but it all could have sort of, all the pieces could have come together at a number of points, and then we might very well have had a trial. So it was close enough. Would it have been a fair trial? You know, it was a one-sided trial, as many of these international trials are, to the extent that they're set up by political bodies as a political initiative. But there's no reason why, if they'd actually set up the court, to think that the judges wouldn't have been able to deliver fair justice. You know, at subsequent trials, we have this. We had acquittals of some of the accused at Nuremberg. We have had acquittals at many of the international courts, and that's always a sign that there's something reasonably fair going on. So he would have had a fair trial, but the problem really was figuring out what the law was, because nobody had ever done this before. And nobody even really thought very much about it. So, you know, by the time 25 years later, when we get to Nuremberg and there's a real trial, they're building on 25 years of reflection, of people writing about this and thinking about it, and, of course, the lessons that they learned from the period in 1919 and 1920 around the trial of the Kaiser.
And do you think he possibly would have been convicted, or is it impossible to tell?
I think it's impossible to tell. I mean, I called the final chapter, I entitled it, "Was He Guilty?" And I reflect on, you know, the different legal and factual issues that would have arisen, but without presuming to know the result. I mean, I've been in the courtroom enough myself over my career and have seen enough trials to know that they're always unpredictable. And, you know, there are any number of imponderable factors that can come into play. So, yes, he could have been convicted. He might have been acquitted, although under the circumstances, it's hard to think they would have gone to all the effort to set up a trial for one person and then find him not guilty. But then, who knows?
What were the attitudes of the different main political leaders on the Allied side? What did Woodrow Wilson think of all of this? Lloyd George, who I mentioned, had talked about hanging the Kaiser in his election materials. And what was the view of the French leader, Clemenceau?
Well, the two real keeners on this were Clemenceau, the French prime minister, and David Lloyd George in the United Kingdom. As you mentioned at the outset, the Italian Prime Minister Orlando was, and the Italians more generally, because he was reflecting the opinion of the sort of political class in Italy, were lukewarm about the subject. The American position is in a way the most interesting, and also because people who follow this subject today or over the decades, of course, we're just obsessed with the attitude of the Americans, who are sometimes extremely enthusiastic about international justice and at other times extremely negative. They're actually in a very negative phase right now in their attitude to the International Criminal Court, where they have denied a visa to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court to be able to go to the United States. So at the time, in 1919, Woodrow Wilson is not enthusiastic, but he's sufficiently opportunistic to see this as just something he'll compromise on with the British and the French in order to find some sort of consensus, some sort of agreement on all of the provisions of the Versailles Treaty. But he is backed up by his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, who is really negative and very, I want to say old-fashioned, because one of the interesting things from this is a very fertile period in terms of international lawmaking, and you have people who come to the peace conference in 1919 and who are engaged in these issues who are excited at the opportunity. They get to make something new, and they know that that's only going to happen once in a lifetime, and they don't want to miss it. They want to take advantage of making as much new law and advancing the pieces on the chessboard as much as they can. There are others who are absolutely terrified by the idea and are conservative and old-fashioned. And so Robert Lansing, the American Secretary of State, is one of those. He doesn't get along that well with Woodrow Wilson. The two men, although, you know, Wilson is number one and Lansing is number two, they barely speak to each other. They communicate in writing. And so Lansing is telling Wilson not to do it, not to do it. But finally, Wilson, in a strange series of meetings that happened in early April of 1919 at the Paris Peace Conference, at a time when he's quite sick, he's physically unwell, and many people think that he wasn't mentally entirely in good health either, and he compromises. The leaders, the four great leaders, meet. So they spend the better part of 2 days discussing this problem. They have a lot of other things to deal with, and but this is central. This is a very important question. And at the end of it, Wilson says, yeah, I guess you can have your trial. And he proposes a text that then gets, he actually writes himself, Woodrow Wilson, one evening. And then he goes back to the other leaders, Clemenceau and Lloyd George in particular. And he says, I don't want to talk about this anymore. Just sign here. And they initial the text that he's written, a couple of paragraphs. And then they give it to the lawyers on what's called the drafting committee and say, you know, polish this up, and that's what goes in the Treaty of Versailles.
I was fascinated by the fact that they had gone back to look at the aftermath of the Battle of Waterloo and the defeat of Napoleon, and that was influencing how the British lawyers approached this possible international trial.
Well, indeed, and it really shows you why this was such a turning point, and why nobody had ever actually really thought much about this idea of an international trial of a leader previously. So when the British look back at the treatment of Napoleon, they find that they had, you know, Napoleon had surrendered to the British. The Prussians wanted him. They wanted just to summarily execute him. But Wellington was enough of, how should I put it, he was polite enough to say, no, we should have a trial. But he said, but we can't try him in England. He hasn't committed a crime against our laws. The only crime he's committed is against the laws of France. So this is the old view of the world. There's no such thing as an international crime, and so you can only be tried if you violate the laws of your own country. And so finally, they say to the French, this is Napoleon, they say to the French government, do you want him? Will you put him on trial for treason? And the French say, no, thank you, you keep him. And so then the British say, well, we can't try him. And they actually adopt a special law because they're also uncomfortable about the idea that they can hold him indefinitely. So Parliament enacts a legislation, and they agree to put him on an island in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. And as everybody knows, I see this as a kind of a, this is where the Americans got the idea for Guantanamo, is just detain him on an island and don't let him have a trial. But when they look at this 1918 and 1919, they look back 100 years and they say, now we can have an international trial and we'll have an international tribunal. So this is what's so brand new about it.
And finally, you mentioned the Nuremberg trials and the lessons maybe learned, the reflections that had taken place in the intervening decades. How much was the Nuremberg trials influenced by the thinking done at this time?
Well, the Americans were really, probably the main driving force in the Nuremberg trials. Of course, I don't want to deny the role that the British and the Soviets, as well as the French, played in it, but the Americans were very central to it. And the man who led the American activities in Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, who was a sitting Supreme Court justice, he knew all about what had happened, or at least he knew a lot of what had happened in 1919, and he was very conscious of the fact that they were rejecting the American position. And he explained that our view has changed because they were reminded in 1944 and 1945 of the conservative approach that the Americans had taken at the end of the First World War. And he was very open about it, saying, well, we've changed our views on this. We have a different approach to it. I should say one other thing about the influence of this material. A lot of it was not known because it wasn't public. I've been able, others have been to much of this material before me, although they may not have looked at this part of it as thoroughly as I did. But the documents about the Paris Peace Conference and the minutes of the meetings of the four leaders were not available in the 1940s. And that material really only became accessible later. And so, there's an extent to which some of the mysteries about the debates that went on in 1919 couldn't have influenced the policymakers in 1944 and 45 because they didn't know about it.
Okay.
We do now.
Very good. Well, it's a wonderful story, and you tell it so well in the book. I'm delighted to have been joined by William A. Shabas, the author of the great new book, The Trial of the Kaiser. It's published in hardback by OUP Oxford. It costs £24.99 sterling, so about €28. And Bill, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. In attempting to understand how the human mind processes thought and uses logic, George Boole put his finger on the secret of mechanized thinking. This led to the digital computer, which controls every aspect of our lives today. A brilliant new book sheds new light on George Boole, and it shows the personal side of a great thinker, a loving husband, a devoted father, a religious maverick, a generous benefactor, and a much-loved teacher. The book is called New Light on George Boole. It's published in hardback by Atrium Cork University Press and costs €19.95. The authors are Desmond McHale and Yvonne Cohn, and you're both very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Desmond, can I ask you first of all about George Boole? Because you've written about him before and you have an excellent biography of him that was recently republished. Tell us about Boole and why he was so important.
Well, Boole was an English mathematician and logician. He was born in Lincoln in 1815. The amazing thing about him is that he was self-taught in languages and mathematics. He never went to secondary school or third level. And he came to Cork in 1849 as first professor of mathematics at Queen's College Cork, which is now University College Cork. So try doing that today, getting a university professorship without a secondary education or without a university degree. He did a lot of mathematical research, but he was most famous for inventing symbolic logic, and he called his magnum opus the laws of thought. In the 20th century, his logic was used as the basis for switching circuits, computers, microchips, smartphones, and I often say to people, if you think you've nothing to do with George Boole, look at your electric kettle. It's got a switch saying one and zero, and that's the whole basis of Boole's algebra. One is for on and zero is for off. And he can consider the father of the digital age. Unfortunately, he died age 49, very premature death, from pneumonia after a wetting he got while walking from Ballantemple in Cork to the university. So if he'd lived another 50 years, he might have discovered an awful lot of other things. But in his short life, he really was a very famous person indeed.
Very good. And Yvonne, I was really interested to see that Boole had surprisingly modern attitudes in a number of areas, including towards the idea of pregnancy and fatherhood.
Yes, that's right. Boole married when he was almost 40 years old. He married a lady called Mary Everest, who was the niece of a colleague of his in Queen's College Cork. And he had been teaching Mary maths when she had visited Cork, and then all of a sudden her father died and he went to visit her, and the next thing they were married. So he was sort of all of a sudden launched into marriage and fatherhood, because they had a honeymoon baby 9 months later. But Boole wrote to a friend of his, Dr. John Berry in Chester, and he was asking him about Mary's health during her pregnancy. And he was worried that some of Mary's friends thought she should be wearing stays or corsets, but he felt that was totally unnecessary. And Boole was obviously supported in that view by Dr. Berry, because after the birth of their baby, he wrote to Dr. Berry to say everything was great. Mary's health was fine. She didn't wear stays. She didn't wear corsets. She had a very easy labour and was breastfeeding with ease on the following day. So I just think it's surprising that a man in the Victorian era would, you know, write so freely and easily to his friend about those matters and with such enthusiasm. Then later on in 1860, after their third daughter was born, Alicia, Boole wrote Dr. Berry to say that there was talk of smallpox in the neighbourhood, and could Dr. Berry please send over the smallpox vaccine so that they could have it administered by the local doctor. So he seemed to be well ahead of the posse, and very open and very hands-on father as well. He wrote to his close friend William Brooke, and you can see from his letters how besotted he was with his new daughter. He was looking for scraps that he had seen in England. He couldn't get them in Ireland and was wondering if Mr. Brooke could send them over for Mary Ellen to play with. And we're fortunate as well that some of his letters to Mary Ellen have survived, and they're just lovely to read. There's a lovely tone to them, how he speaks to her. She was only a small child when he died, but they're a lovely legacy to have.
Desmond, can I ask you about what Boole thought of the Irish famine? What did he do during that period?
Well, Boole arrived in Ireland in 1849. Well, although the official famine, I suppose, was over, the country was still suffering from the devastation that the famine had caused, or the Great Hunger, as we call it. On his first train journey from Dublin to Cork, he saw desolation and devastation everywhere. He had never seen anything like it, that the whole countryside was, you know, clearly devastated at the famine, that there were no people about, that everything looked miserable, there were no crops in the fields, there were no animals in the fields. And one Sunday when he was actually in Cork, he used to go from church to church to hear the sermons and to hear the music. And he wandered accidentally into a laneway in Cork City, and there were people that he described as like walking corpses, walking skeletons, that had come in from the countryside looking for food, because there was no food available. And he was absolutely scared of this, as anybody would be, and he was frightened of this. But he showed a great sympathy for the Irish people. He went to West Cork, he went to Bantry, and he went into famine cabins, and he shared, you know, the sorrow that the people were suffering. On the other hand, he would write letters to the newspapers about the treatment of donkeys in Cork City, so that he had a sort of English thing about treating animals, maybe sometimes more important than human beings. So it was a double standard, in a sense, that he didn't seem to be too concerned about the people that were walking the streets in hunger, but he was concerned with animals. But he was a very, very generous person. He gave a lot of money, and he was a charitable man. He lent from his meagre income to friends and to acquaintances and people hard on their luck. And it's peculiar that, you know, he would have never seen anything like famine in England, as most people wouldn't have. And most of the people in Cork City, most of the well-off people in Cork City, they didn't have famine either. And Boole complained that at dinners for the local clergy and for the local aldermen and all the people like that, there were 5-6 courses of the most exotic foods, while not very far away in the countryside, people were starving. But unfortunately, like many people in Victorian times, he felt that the Irish should be able to get out of this with their own efforts, educate themselves, work. He didn't seem to appreciate the dreadful conditions of the famine, that people weren't able to work, they weren't able to get out of it, there was nothing in the countryside for them. So it's an interesting thing to see somebody, an academic, who'd never experienced hunger in his life, watching hunger all round about him in Cork City.
And Vaughan, he was a superb teacher. What was he like as a professor of mathematics with his students?
Well, we're fortunate that a body of letters survived that were written by some of his former students after his death. They were written to his widow, Mary Boole. And the way the esteem that they held in him was remarkable. One student wrote that it was almost like the loss of a father when he heard of Boole's death. They held him in such high regard, they felt he was very fair, that he taught as though he was learning with them all the time, that it wasn't that he was just reproducing material, that he brought them along, and that as if he was discovering the material as he went. They said nobody wanted to disappoint him. He also, when he was unwell, he invited students to his home. So his family were acquainted with the students, and they really were part of his family. As well as that, when before he had come to Cork, he had been a school teacher. He had taught in schools and also had two schools of his own. And we're fortunate that one of his pupils, called Charles Clark, after he retired in Canada, Clark became involved in politics in Canada, and he became the Speaker of the Provincial Parliament in Ontario. And he wrote a book called 60 Years in Upper Canada. And in that book, he gives a great account of his life as a pupil of Boole's and the way that Boole ran his schools. He said the only time he ever saw Boole lose control of himself was when he caught a boy stealing eggs from a bird's nest. And in 1877, Charles Clark actually introduced legislation in Canada protecting birds and prohibiting the robbing or destruction of birds' nests. So Boole clearly had a big effect on him and all the other pupils that he taught.
Very good. And Desmond, finally, an intriguing section of the book, an intriguing chapter, is the theory that George Boole may have been the inspiration for Sherlock Holmes's arch enemy, Professor James Moriarty.
Well, this is one of the most controversial aspects of our book, and some people bound to agree with it. But we think we've made a very good case for this, because Professor James Moriarty was an Irish-sounding name, and I mean a Kerry name. And he was a mathematician. And if you look at his the papers that he did in mathematics, they're very close to the papers that Boole wrote. And he also, there are physical resemblance to Boole. If you look at the only known photograph of Boole and the drawings of James Moriarty by Sidney Paget in the Sherlock Holmes story, I think they look very alike indeed. They were very similar in many ways. And we feel that we made a good case for the fact that Boole was the inspiration for Moriarty. We feel the villain of the piece was H.G. Wells, who was a friend of Conan Doyle's, and we think together they conspired to take the saintly Boole and to actually turn him into, invert him and pervert him, as Doyle did with many characters, and turn the saintly man into an arch-villain. And we came across a passage from Mary Evers Boole, who was Boole's widow, and she said, "It is a curious thing that all my husband's early friends speak of him as if he had been a saint from his cradle, as if evil had been naturally further for him and goodness easier for him than other men. I think, on the contrary, that I never saw anyone in whom the possibilities of evil seemed more rife." Now, this is an extraordinary statement for a wife, and a good wife, to write about her husband. But if Arthur Conan Doyle saw that, and it was published in an Irish magazine, he might have said to himself, okay, let's turn the great and saintly and wonderful and clever Boole upside down and turn him into an arch-villain. And if it's true, Boole will become better known than he is already, because virtually everybody in the world has heard of Sherlock Holmes and his arch-villain, Professor James Moriarty.
Oh, well, congratulations to both of you on the book. It's called A New Light on George Boole. It's published in hardback by Atrium and costs €19.95. The authors are Desmond McHale and Yvonne Cohn. And thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Talking History on News Talk. Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. A new book provides a cultural history of the renowned Mam Trasna murders from the perspective of language change in late 19th century Ireland. It's an award-winning book called The Mam Trasna Murders, Language, Life and Death in 19th Century Ireland. It's published in paperback by UCD Press and costs €20. The author is Margaret Kelleher. And Margaret, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks, Patrick.
Well, maybe our listeners will be familiar with this case because of that, the pardon from President Michael D. Higgins recently. And it's a case that I think shocked a lot of people at the time in the late 19th century. It inspired writers like James Joyce. It caught the popular imagination. Maybe tell our listeners about what was it about the Mam Trasna murders that was so controversial and so entrancing?
Yes, starting with the pardon itself, it made history. It was the first posthumous pardon given to someone who was convicted prior to the establishment of the Irish state. So itself a historic act by President Higgins. And I think it showed the lingering interest in the case, but also the sense of an injustice that all these decades, even well over a century later, needs to be repaired. The central events of the case happened on the night of the 17th of August, 1882, in Mam Trasla, a townland on the border of Mayo and Galway. And it comprised a series of brutal murders, the details of which really remained very graphic. Five members of the Joyce family were brutally killed by a group of people. They included John Joyce and his wife. They also included John's elderly mother, who was about 80, his teenage daughter and his teenage son. And one son, Patsy, who was only 8 years of age, survived of his injuries. In the days afterwards, a number of men were arrested, going through a series of events, which of course are detailed in the book. Ultimately, 10 men were originally accused, 8 stood trial, and most famously, Miles Joyce was convicted, was executed of the crime, and we now know, as indeed I think many people at the time sensed, that he was innocent.
And that's what's so extraordinary about the case, the fact that there was this evidence showing that he was innocent, even some of the other people who were on trial proclaiming his innocence. And there also, I think, was a miscarriage in that he did not understand what was going on during the case, because it was being all done in English.
Yes, central to this case is the issue of language, and that's one of the reasons I was interested myself in going back to the book. We've known about the case thanks to the great work of the late Father Waldron, also recent work by Sean O'Curran, which in turn led to the Irish language documentary. But my own interest is in language shift in 19th century Ireland, and the details of that language shift make the case so striking and such a revealing indicator. As you say, Miles Joyce spoke Irish only. In many ways, Patrick, my own journey through this case, at the beginning of my research, I used to say he spoke only Irish. I now say he spoke Irish only. And it's a subtle but I think very telling shift. He was a monolingual speaker of Irish, but he wasn't extended the proper interpretive services. I mean, even more strangely, an interpreter was in court, an RIC constable, who was pressed into service to translate some of the prosecution witnesses who were also monolingual speakers of Irish. But the interpreter was not made available to Miles Joyce, and his services were only made available at the very end when the verdict was explained to him. And there's a sense, when you look at the newspaper's account at the time, of a kind of concern in the court. Can you imagine this man, his early 40s, unable to understand what happened, and then the verdict of guilty was pronounced upon him. The jury exited for some 6 minutes to decide on the verdict. So one of my sources is the newspaper accounts of the time, where his passionate plea of innocence, which was translated simultaneously in the court by the interpreter, and then that translation was reproduced in the papers in the following days, really show an unease in the court even then, which was as far back as November 1882.
I can understand why it is an award-winning book, because it not only tells that story so powerfully, it also is a reflection, a meditation on issues of language and identity and how they are so interconnected and entwined with this story. You do get a great insight into maybe attitudes towards the Irish language at the time, and maybe attitudes towards Irish people in general, that certainly in the way that the trial was being reported in English periodicals and newspapers. Was Miles Joyce then just a victim who was caught up in this?
In many ways, one has to make one's way through, I think, layers of condescension, as you say, in terms of some of the sources. And the archival work that I did was really important to the case. In many ways, my ambition for the book is to put the language shift back into how we think about 19th century Ireland. There's a way in which we see that language shift as inevitable. But as you well know, as a historian, a large social shift is never seen as inevitable to the people who are experiencing it. And of course, for Ireland to move from a society that was predominantly Irish speaking to being predominantly English speaking meant that we had to have a number of generations that were bilingual. So much of my interest in the book is about where can we find evidence for that bilingualism. So, for example, Miles Joyce was a monolingual, but many of the people in his neighbourhood and in his immediate vicinity were bilingual. I suppose most famously in the Mam Trasna case, two of the men accused were bilingual. They were labourers who had gone back and forth to England. They were quite comfortable in English, and they turned Queen's evidence because in many ways they had the linguistic capacity, the competence to deal directly with the prosecution counsel. So definitely Miles Joyce's monolingualism rendered him vulnerable, particularly in a state that refused to accept really that monolingual speakers of Irish were still current. But one of the things I found, for example, in the barony of Ross, where Miles Joyce lived in 1881, according to the census, 90% of the population spoke Irish, and half of those spoke Irish only. I'm sometimes mischievously led to think that the people who were isolated in that area were the 10% who spoke English only, though obviously they lived in a very different social class. So as I say, much of my ambition for the book is to really complicate our narrative of language change in Ireland, and in many ways to reclaim a history of bilingualism, and that is much closer to us than we think, and that in turn I think leads to interesting implications for Ireland today in the early 21st century, where in a way I think bilingualism is itself emerging from the new communities, from intermarriage and families, and I think it's actually good for us as a society to realise that bilingualism and a much more complex history of language is part of our story.
Why did the story inspire and intrigue people like James Joyce so much?
It's a good question. One of the answers, I think, to that is Joyce's father, John Stanislas Joyce, was a very good friend of Tim Harrington, the MP, who was really one of the first campaigners of the book. And quite extraordinarily, in 1884, just 2 years after the murders and the trials and the executions, he published a pamphlet naming those whom he believed to be innocent and those whom he believed to be guilty. And indeed, his findings really stand up all these decades later. So my theory really is that Joyce would have first heard about that from his father. I think he also heard stories from Nora Barnacle, folk stories about Miles Joyce, about Miles Joyce's ghost, about the madness of the governor of Galway jail, really continue to reverberate in local Galway society. So I think Joyce was interested in that. I think the case haunted him in a way. One of the things I say in the book, sometimes Joyce and colleagues are less grateful to me in this. He actually gets some of the facts wrong. but his interest in law and language, I think, are really credible and laudatory. Of course, the late Justice Hardiman did wonderful work on that very topic, on Joyce's fascination with law. And he came back to the case in Finnegan's Wake, and I think there actually got the facts more right. So it was a case that really stayed with him over decades in James Joyce's own life.
It's very interesting what you say there about it having haunted, and there is a haunting element to the story of Miles Joyce because it is such a miscarriage, it is such a travesty, it is such a tragedy, and it's even more frustrating the fact that at the time there was enough known for him not to have been executed, and it makes... It makes the tragedy all the more terrible. And is that why the story continues to resonate?
That's true. I think it's a salutary case, and I do think we're very lucky to have had campaigners over the years, including Sean O'Ciaran, whom I mentioned earlier, also Johnny Joyce, who is a great grandson of the murdered John Joyce, who I think with great generosity campaigned for the innocence of Miles Joyce. It's also a case that has very salutary things for us today about standards of interpreting in our public courts in 21st century Ireland. And in the conclusion of the book, I really aim to bring it to our present. And I hope readers will stay with the story and think about its implications for today.
OK, well, I think that's a brilliant note on which to end our discussion tonight. Margaret, congratulations on the book, deserving of all the awards. So well done. It's The Mam Trasna Murders, Language, Life and Death in 19th Century Ireland, published in paperback by UCD Press and costs €20. The author, Margaret Kelleher, and we'll be back with more Talking History right after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History with me, Patrick Gagan. A new history of the Brigidines, formerly known as the Sisters of St. Bridget, expands the current knowledge of the congregation and its mission to the rural communities of Ireland, America, Australia and New Zealand. It's called the Brigidine Sisters in Ireland, America, Australia and New Zealand, 1807 to 1922. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €60. The author is Anne Power. And Anne, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Oh, thank you very much indeed, Patrick, for having me.
Can we go back to 1807 and the founding of the order by Bishop Daniel Delaney? Why was it founded?
He wanted to catechise the young children of the diocese and also the women of the diocese. And he had catechetics, but the catechists were leaving, and so he decided to found the orders of nuns. Now, he did try and have the presentation come to the diocese, but they weren't interested, so he founded his own order, the Sisters of St. Bridget, in 1807. And the first sisters were six catechists, and they were all in their late, say, 30s to 40s, so they weren't young children.
And I think it's really fascinating going through the book to see what it was like to enter the order, the costs involved and so on, and those that were excluded. So maybe talk us through that. How did one become a sister of St. Bridget?
One had to have a recommendation from your mother superior of your school. You also had a recommendation from your parish priest, but it was preferable to have the recommendation of both. And then that went to the bishop and went to the convent. They then interviewed you, and it was depending on, the bishop had the final say as to who has been interviewed.
And it seems to have, there were costs involved as well.
Oh, the costs were absolutely staggering. And Bishop Delaney set aside £9,000 of his own money, which would be roughly over €730,000 today. But that wasn't enough to cover them. So the sisters had to take in laundry, altar washing and other menial tasks such as mangling clothes and all that just to keep themselves going. Plus what they were getting from teaching in the poor school and in the benefit school.
Was there a class division involved between those who became involved?
Oh, yes, there was. You had both lay sisters and choir sisters. The choir sisters had to bring about £600 was the minimum they could bring in 1828. And that was ordered by Bishop Doyle. And that equates roughly to about €75,000 in today's money. But there was also then the lay sisters who came in, but they didn't bring any money with them. But just their service as servants to the convent was all that counted.
And this changed, though, after the famine.
Oh, it did. The dower that they brought dropped to £200 to £300.
Let's talk about their contribution to the world of education, because they seem to have made significant contributions there and have significant achievements to their credit. Was that perhaps their greatest legacy in the 19th century?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they only had four convents in the diocese, and they didn't go beyond the diocese of Kildare and Loughton, but they did spread to Australia in 1883, first to New South Wales and then to Victoria. And then later on, they went to New Zealand and they really spread from there.
And what about the United States?
They did go in the 1840s and they were spent about 10 years there. But that failed in the end because they didn't get the support they needed either from the bishops or from the home.
I got the sense that life for some of these nuns was actually quite hard. And you have the case study of Mother Borgia, who was refused permission to return to Ireland.
Yes, if you entered without a dower, and when just use your education as a means into the convent, you were professed as a choir sister, but you had to go to Australia. And there was no question of you returning to Ireland. She wished to return to Ireland. She went to Australia in 1893 and wished to return from New Zealand in 1911, but the Mother General wouldn't allow her.
You also have some good stories of family members who joined, and there seems to be that close family connection in the order.
Oh, absolutely. You had groups of sisters, you had two aunts, you had and our two nieces, you had four cousins, three Sinans and the one Conway from Limerick. You had the Lennon sisters, you had the Hayden sisters, and they were just one sample of the family acquaintances in the order.
And a final question, Anne. I wonder how prestigious was it for a family to have someone in the Brigidines? Was it something that was valued by families and communities?
Oh, yes, it was. I mean, you had to have at least £600 to enter, so therefore you're of that social level. And really, it ended up at most of the nuns in the 1860s from there onwards were from strong tenant farming families. the farms ranged from 100 to 400 acres. Then you had two of the fathers were gentlemen. Some were attorneys, some were surgeons, some were publicans, and generally in business.
Very good. Okay, well, Anne, congratulations on the book. It's called The Brigidine Sisters in Ireland, America, Australia and New Zealand, 1807 to 1922. It's published in hardback by Four Courts Press and costs €60. The author is Anne Power. And Anne, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you indeed, Patrick.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this. Talking History on News Talk. Well, welcome back. And to end the show tonight, we're going to look at the history of a Wicklow townland and its farming community. A story that has been brilliantly told by Margaret Connolly in a new book, A Howl, Where the Divil Ate the Tinker. It's published in paperback by Applefield Publishing. It costs €18. And Margaret, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thanks very much, Patrick.
It's a very interesting idea because you've been able to tell a remarkable story and a very large story from this history of a small townland. Tell us about A Howl. And it has a silent G in there.
It does, yes. And to confuse the issue, there are two A Howls in Wicklow. There's one up near the Carlow border, which most people know about, and very few people know about the other A Howl, which is down between Ashford and Roundwood. It's a small rural area under a mountain called Carrick Mountain. And I grew up there in the 1960s on a traditional farm. Now, when I was born, there were seven traditional farms still there. And during the course of my childhood, all of those farms disappeared. And in recent times, it occurred to me that all the history that was handed down with the land and with the folklore and everything else of the area would disappear unless somebody recorded it.
And you seem to have been able to put together an incredible amount of material. What were the records like? How difficult was it going through those sources?
Well, I was quite surprised because it's an area where nothing famous ever happened and there were small tenant farmers. So you would think other than appearing in the census or maybe the state records for births, marriages and deaths and church records, there wouldn't be any records. But strangely enough, there was a lot of kind of hidden records like the petty court records, which are now online from about 1840. I found nearly everybody appeared that lived in the townland at some stage, whether they were drunk coming home from the fair, which often did happen, or they were fighting with their neighbour over a turf bank or little things like that. They turned up there. Even dog licences was a useful source for me. From about the 1850s on, they had to license their dogs every 6 months. So you found out, like when somebody died, it transferred to the next person that took over the lease of the leaseholder that would license the dog. So you were able to piece together who lived in the house from those sources. Then the internet was a great source as well. I was able to connect with people who had emigrated during the famine time. And they might have known they came from Wicklow, but didn't know exactly where in Wicklow they'd come from. And because they had information up on internet sites and things, I was able to kind of complete the circle for them. They would tell me what happened to the family after they emigrated. And I was able to tell them, you know, the life the family had before they emigrated. And in some cases, they came back to the townland to visit it since.
And it's interesting because the book, in a way, is almost a case study of Ireland's relationship with emigration and our history there, because there's so much there and not just during the time of the famine.
Oh, it's true. It was a constant theme I found. Like, there were only 25 houses in the area just before the famine, which dropped to 20 houses after the famine and was down to 10 by 1901. But from all of those houses, there was a constant stream of emigration. Sometimes entire families went, and sometimes it was just the younger members of the family. The oldest son stayed to work the land and the rest went Australia, New Zealand, Canada, England. And I was able to trace back and even get photographs and records from people about, you know, the life they had afterwards after they emigrated.
And we get a great insight into how farms ran in this time and the relationship between tenant farmers and their landlords, but also a great insight into the role that women played in the running of these farms.
Yeah, it was only when I had done all the research and reflected back on it that I realised that the women had quite a significant role in those farms in the times when that a lot of people wouldn't have thought of farming or wouldn't have thought of women having a role. That kind of, first of all, I noticed the leases when the time of the landlord, the lease was obviously with the husband. But if the husband died young, the lease transferred to the wife, not to the oldest son. And in some cases, she held on to that till she was 90 before she gave it to the son, who was now married with children of his own. And in my own time and the oral history records I had of people living there, like the women made butter, they sold it to the local shops, they kept fowl, they sold eggs, they were out in the farms working alongside their husbands, as well as rearing probably 8 or 10 children in a two-roomed house, you know.
There seems to have been a great community spirit at this time, and for whatever reason, it seems to have been something that sustained and supported the families.
Well, it did. I suppose it was born out of necessity because they were so such a small community, and they depended on one another very much. They had very little, and their whole existence depended on paying their rent each year. So they had to come together. And even then, you know, in the 20th century, when they were trying to build up the little farms after they got ownership of them, they very much needed to work together. And a lot of the photographs and things I have from the 1920s, 30s, 40s shows 4 or 5 different families coming together to make hay or shear sheep or whatever.
Well, Margaret, congratulations on all your research. A very interesting story indeed. It's Where the Divil Ate the Tinker, and great title as well.
There's a story behind that, but we haven't time for it today.
Well, actually, we'll add on an extra few. What was the inspiration
it
for that?
It goes back to 1798 when there was a rebel on the run called Dinny Byrne, and he was needed to get to Ahowl to hide out there, and he disguised himself as a tinker, which would have been a tinsmith at the time, going from farm to farm. The yeomen knew about this and they were chasing him. Now, he got to Ahowl and they surrounded the whole valley thinking, we have him now. But there was a cave up on the rocks and he hid out there and they couldn't find him. They searched the whole place. They were meant to have burnt out houses and everything, and cursed the place as where the divil must have ate the tinker. And even as a child, like 150 years later, 200 years later, when I said it was from Ahowl, somebody will say, where the divil ate the tinker.
Where the divil ate the tinker. Yeah. Okay, a wonderful book and worth buying even for that story. Mm. It's published in paperback by Applefield Publishing. It costs €18. And Margaret Connolly, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
And that does bring us, I'm afraid, to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cahill, my producer, and Chris Bent on sound. Next week, well, we are going to start the new month with a look at some of the best new books out there to get you into the mood for the summer with some great reading. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.
History on News Talk.